Duck, duck, goose! Duck of Minerva in stereo.
So this is Dan Nexon.
And this is Patrick Jackson.
And welcome to the first substantive podcast of the Duck of Minerva.
Yay.
This being Patrick and Dan, I thought that we would begin by talking a bit about something that Patrick and I have been discussing for a while, which is the pedagogy of using science fiction to teach politics. And I think this is a sort of interesting topic because not only have there been a slew of books either that have come out recently or that we know of that are about to come out about using science fiction and fantasy to teach international relations, you know, the most famous being Theories of International Politics and Zombies, but also there being, you know, the Lord of the Rings book and a bunch of other books, but also because, you know, some of the newer political science blogs have done a post here or there about political science fiction and things like that. This seemed like a good topic to start us out with. And adding to all this, Patrick's just finished teaching his science fiction course this summer. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that course and what your primary motivation in it is?
Great. Well, the course, Social Science Fiction, I like to – it's not quite a joke. I sort of say to my students I designed the syllabus for this when I was 12, and I actually did. I mean, I actually remember when I was much younger thinking about, okay, wouldn't it be fun to teach a class on some of this really great science fiction stuff? The thing that really kind of crystallized it for me was actually not quite when I was 12. It was when I was about 14 when I was reading Watchmen when it first came out, and I said, this is a book about politics. And this is a book about politics that's a lot more interesting than reading the newspaper. So that's cool. I wonder what you could do with that. And I prevailed on an English teacher of mine to actually assign it. And so we actually had a couple of class sessions talking about Watchmen. And that just sort of whet my appetite for it. But the basic idea as the syllabus sort of and the idea of it grew over the years was to try to explore what goes on in a good piece of science fiction, which is a kind of world building that has to be plausible without being true, right? Because historical fiction and other kinds of genres are able to buttress their sense of reality by dropping in references to events that we all think of as real, whereas the challenge that goes on in science fiction is precisely that since it's not real, right? It's something that is demonstrably different than the way we ordinarily think about things. How does that sense of reality get conveyed in the course of a good piece of science fictional world building?
Well, let me interrupt you here for a second, because I think that a lot of some science fiction studies writers would say that that's not quite right, that in fact, in a sense, all fiction is science fiction because it all builds another world, and that even in science fiction and fantasy, you have the deployment of events, idioms, terms, thematic references, other kind of elements, rhetorical commonplaces, to use a phrase you like, from our world as a way of buttressing their reality.
Mm-hmm.
So Watchmen is a good example of this, right? I mean, Watchmen is alternate history in many respects. So it's a science fiction setting, but it's one that achieves its resonance through the repetition of events, themes, ideas from our world.
Yes, but the kind of repetition that something like Watchmen in particular does is more of a counterfactual repetition. So it's not, let me just simply tell you about an event that's already happened or drop in a reference to something that's already happened. The nice thing about Watchmen in particular is it's a very systematic examination of how would history have been different if there happened to have been superheroes on the U.S. side of the Cold War. So there's all these great explorations of the difference that Dr. Manhattan makes, say, to the arms race. I guess there's a certain amount of kind of reality factor created by the fact that they're talking about things like the Vietnam War, but it's so obviously different that I think the intellectual labor and the artistic labor in creating a really good co-tenable counterfactual is different than what you get in a piece of non-genre fiction, which would more closely purport to be adhering to the actual course of events. So science fiction as a kind of extended, self-conscious counterfactual is sort of the intellectual foundation for how I was kind of thinking about this. And I do think that is measurably different and meaningfully different than, you know, what you get in a standard kind of, I don't know, take a standard like romantic comedy or something where, okay, we're in New York and it's New York. Like, everybody knows it's New York, and we do all these kind of New York references, and, oh, look, now we have the sense of reality of it being New York. Yes, in some sense, that's, quote unquote, a new world that's been constructed, but I guess there's not the same kind of self-conscious counterfactuality attached to it. So I don't think you can do quite as much with the genre as you can with something like sci-fi. You have this great potential to be able to explore all of these very different manifestations of politics and social relations. And that, I think, is the really intriguing thing.
So in a sense, what you're saying is that the more complicated relationship between plausibility and non-plausibility that's embedded in science fiction, and we could arguably say that we could make the case that this is true of some fantasy as well, allows for certain kinds of political discussion exploration of a type that you wouldn't get elsewhere. Is that
precisely? Because to use sort of a technical term, right? It kind of alienates the viewer or the reader from the. It alienates the viewer from the representation, right? So here I have something that purports to be a neutral representation. If it's a non-genre piece of fiction, then I just kind of look through it. Whereas with science fiction, it's always very clear that I'm placed outside of it, right? I'm looking at it, it's like, this is a non-true thing, but it still has a sense of true to it. It still seems to capture something about it. And the weird thing for me, the reason why I thought about doing this as science fiction and social science is because it's the same sort of sense, I think, that you get from reading some of the best pieces of social science. They're clearly not quote-unquote true in the sense of being picture-perfect representations. They don't purport to be picture-perfect representations, but they capture something of import about the thing, right? By pulling the observer away from it, you get to turn it around and look at it in different angles, and you learn something new about the situation. And I think the same thing happens in a good piece of sci-fi about revolution. I mean, move from Watchmen for a second. Think about something like The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, you know, the famous Heinlein novel, which I love teaching. What does Heinlein do? He takes a whole series of different theories of revolution, and he says, all right, let's play these things out on the moon. So you change the resource constraint question a little bit, and then you end up with this very interesting exploration of what a plausible revolution would look like. And I think you gain certain insights in how political order works from an exercise like that.
Well, that raises it's funny because I was going to ask you to concretize this by talking about something specific from your course, and you just did. But I am going to come back, I hope, to asking you to concretize some other thematics. But the Heinlein example raises a really interesting question, and I think it's one that anybody who's a political scientist would have about the nature of a social science fiction course. Which is, Heinlein, yes, has an account of revolution in Moon is a Harsh Mistress, but why is that a better or a preferable account of revolution than teaching something by a scholar who spent years, if not a lifetime, studying actual historical revolutions?
Say a little more about better. What do you mean by better? What's the goal that we're trying to achieve with something like this? If a point of teaching a particular thing on revolutions is to learn something about an actual revolution that occurred, then Moon is a Harsh Mistress is probably not the right place to start. Since as far as we know, there has not yet been a penal colony on the moon that has revolted, so I don't know what you get that way. But I do think that what you learn from something like The Moon is a Harsh Mistress is there are certain kinds of I don't know, transposable or portable insights about social order that then may show up in different places, recombined in different ways. The nice thing about a fictional setting is, in some ways, what you might call the theory can become a lot clearer. You know, actual reality is really messy. Unless you've got a really good social scientist who's able to, you know, deploy some pretty clear ideal typical mechanisms and configurational patterns and such, and then show you how those play out in practice, then you can sort of lose the forest for the trees. And you just end up with, here's a really good account of, I don't know, the color revolutions in Eastern Europe or something. And now I know something about what went on in these particular revolutions, but I may not have as good a sense of what the overall analytics are that are being utilized within a study like this. And a really good contextualized study of particular revolutions is going to tell you things about those situations, but it may be very difficult to figure out what you can take from that and apply to other things.
Well, that strikes me as fairly counterintuitive, because if you think about a book like The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, it is a tacit theory of revolutions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, Starship Troopers, which is a book that I think we both taught, has a tacit theory of revolutions that we would generally think is kind of bunk. Right.
Right.
You know, a good book on theories of revolutions, you know, I don't know, Scotch, Paul, or what have you, would have an explicit theory of revolutions, followed by a series of cases designed to illustrate that point. So I still would press you, if I had my full IMA normal conventional political science hat on, and saying, you know, is it really worth it at the end of the day to teach Heinlein's ideas about revolutions rather than teaching Scotch Poles?
I don't know that I would call it an either or. Right? It's not Heinlein's ideas in contradistinction to Scotch Poles, and I don't think that the value of Heinlein's account of revolution is that it is better or worse than Scotch Poles when applied to actual events. I think that the value of Heinlein is, frankly, Heinlein tells a better story than Scotch Pole does. I mean, he's a better author. He writes in a way that conveys more of that kind of sense of narrative flow. And so students can read that and say, all right, this is how one might construct a certain kind of analytical narrative. Now, what would happen if you tried to conduct that kind of analytical narrative, tried to construct it on the basis of theoretical tools that had first proven their worth in studies of things that actually occurred? What would that kind of social science look like? And we have very, very few good examples of that. I mean, you mentioned Scotch Pole. I wouldn't have gone there. I sort of would have gone maybe for Jim Scott. I think Scott is one of the few people we have in political science now who does a really fantastic job. I mean, obviously, Chuck was the master of this, right? A lot of Tilly's work was able to do this very, very nicely. I was able to say, here are sets of relatively spare, analytical, theoretically defined mechanisms, which then we put together and we show how they explicate these particular cases. So I don't think, in a sense, that you learn from something like The Moon is a Harsh Mistress about revolutions as much as you learn about how to do a certain kind of social science about revolutions, if that makes sense.
Okay, well, I think that it may be that there's a kind of implied aspect to what you're saying that maybe we ought to bring out more, which is you alluded to earlier when you were talking about cognitive estrangement, right, which is one of the sort of shibboleths of science fiction, right? You sort of alluded to cognitive estrangement back when we were discussing what made science fiction particularly interesting from a kind of counterfactual perspective.
Right.
My guess is that part of what you're arguing about the pedagogy of teaching science fiction is rooted in cognitive estrangement for the students who are reading it. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. And if I had been a little bit more on the ball when discussing that, I would have actually thrown in the term cognitive estrangement. So yes, I'll take that.
Do you want to elaborate on that?
Honestly, the reason I don't tend to immediately reach for the term cognitive estrangement is that the word cognitive still throws me, and the word estrangement just kind of by itself sounds entirely too Marxist for my taste. So, I mean, I which is kind of why I go back for something like alienation, but also because of the nice pun in terms of the science fiction and alienation aspect of things. But I think there is something about distancing. There's something about... All right, actually, let me back up. Let me try this a little bit differently. I teach at a school, as you do, in Washington, D.C., where we have lots of students who are policy wonks and complete political junkies. And they get so wrapped up in the day-to-day existing details of things that it overwhelms whatever else they might actually be thinking about. So I'm glad I'm not teaching right now, because if I were teaching a class right now, I would have a hard time teaching a class that didn't inevitably turn into some discussion of Syria, right? Because that's sort of the big thing in the news right now, so everybody would kind of flock right to that. And I think there's a very important part of education that requires pulling yourself out of this day-to-day embeddedness in the flow of facts. And one of the things I always find when I teach the social science fiction class is people start off with, oh, I'm really interested in politics, but I'm kind of a sci-fi geek, and I think this will be kind of fun. And by the end of the class, they go, wow, you know, Orson Scott Card actually has theories about social organization. And they realize somehow that authors, when they're actually presenting things and creating these fictional worlds, actually have theoretical content. They're making claims about things. And that, just watching that kind of expansion of horizons for the students is the thing I find the most rewarding about it. If one wants to call that cognitive estrangement, I suppose one can call that cognitive estrangement. The vocabulary always kind of rolls oddly off my tongue.
I mean, what's really funny for those of us who have some familiarity with recent science fiction is that the way that you've described the vocation of social science and getting your students to think like social scientists could be straight out of Anathem.
Yep. Anathem was one of the most bizarre books for me to read recently, because I read it and was kind of like, oh, right, I live there. I think Neal Stephenson did a better job in that book articulating a lot of my dissatisfaction with the contemporary U.S. academy than a lot of the quote-unquote realistic writing on American higher education did, because Stephenson was just able to very nicely express, I think, a view of education as being about gaining space from the day-to-day so that one could contemplate things in a broader sense. And I think he expresses that in a way that I find much more compelling than, I don't know, pick any random recent book on the decline of American higher education. I think that's I would go live there.
Except for at the end of the day, it's the breaking down of those barriers that's crucial to. Anyway, well, we can talk more about that at some other in some other context. But I think
should get him on a podcast and we should talk about that.
Right. So I think though what you're saying is interesting, because it's very different from the approach to teaching international relations through speculative fiction that we're seeing as the predominant focus of what's being published recently, right? I mean, because that work primarily says, okay, let's teach realism, liberalism, constructivism, bureaucratic politics, and let's do so by using a speculative fiction setting. So the really successful book at this is Dan Dresner's Theories of International Politics and Zombies, which I think is successful in part because it's just a really good, quick explication of those theories. Mm-hmm. But it says, let's understand those theories by understanding how people who were realists would think about a zombie attack, right?
Right.
I think that's something similar although I haven't seen the final draft, but it's something along the same lines of what motivates the Lord of the Rings and
yes.
International Relations Project. So how is what you're talking about specifically distinctive from that approach?
Well, there's two things about Dresner's book that sort of bothered me. One of them is that I still think that zombies were the wrong choice because they're a naturalized threat, and so you don't get into these politics of recognition stuff quite the same way as you do when you're dealing with aliens, which is why I much prefer to do this with science fiction than I do with zombies. But the other thing that kind of bothered me about Dan's book is precisely this the same thing that about the Lord of the Rings book. The same thing is, I don't know, there was this recent book on Shrek and politics, and about half the chapters in there were, you know, let's run certain kinds of theories through the Shrek universe. And that always seems to me the point of that kind of exercise, right, is to communicate the theory to the students. And yeah, you can do that, but it just seems to me that really is not taking the best advantage of the product you actually have in front of you, because you're looking at a compelling piece of science fiction, a compelling piece of fantasy. You've got something that already has its own theoretical content, and you've got something where the author has not just explicated a theory, but has used that theory to produce a narrative. And in so doing, I mean, yeah, you could say, you know, what would a realist make of, of Aragorn's tactics when it comes to confronting the armies of Mordor? But that just seems to me to miss the whole point, which is that Tolkien already has an idea about how politics works. It's embedded in the very narrative itself. So I think that would be the distinction I would draw. we can use these things as if they were just, you know, case study material from some alternate table of cases and then apply our own theories to them. Or we could actually look at the product and try to extract the theoretical content from it itself. And when I teach this stuff, I'm almost exclusively on the second side of that. Sometimes students will want to kind of pull the discussion over into the first side, and, you know, let it go for a few minutes and then say, okay, but remember we did this. It's funny, I read Ender's Game early on in my courses. Part of the reason for that is because it's a book that a lot of people who would sign up for a science fiction and politics class have probably already read, because Ender's Game being the sort of, you know, geek classic, especially among a certain group of people who grew up to be nerds. And so Ender's Game is one that they've sort of already gotten, and they get into it, and then they immediately want to just sort of say, oh, look, you know, General Graf is articulating kind of a realist view of threat here. And so, you know, you let that discussion go on for 5-10 minutes, and they say, all right, let's pull back from that for a second. What does Card think about this? And usually there's just this moment of blank stares, and they go, what do you mean? I said, no, not what the character says in the book. Like, you can find this thing and map it onto what some potted summary of IR realism is, but what happens to that perspective over the course of the novel? What does Card think about this? What is the theory in the novel itself? And then people kind of go and start, the discussion starts back up a little bit more slowly. But by the end of it, they're getting to, oh, wait, these representations are not somehow neutral representations. They are themselves perspectives on reality. And as far as I'm concerned, that, you know, if they learn nothing else in the class, then they've learned something really important.
So it might be too simple to put it this way, but it sounds like you're advocating choosing works of science fiction or fantasy or whatever other genre you'd be using in a political science, social science course, choosing those the same way you would choose books in any other course, right? A normal social science text, which is you would choose things that had interesting things to say, that were or could be placed in dialogue with one another,
yes,
in which communicated different perspectives on key themes that you wanted your students to talk about.
Yes.
Is that fair?
I think so. I think the only other thing that I would say to supplement that I found very helpful over the years is to assign books that are sequels or within a particular tradition with each other. So when I assign Ender's Game, I'll usually assign Speaker for the Dead as well. It's harder to do this in regular social science because people don't usually write part two. But the nice thing about something like the pairing of Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead is you have the same author exploring issues in slightly different ways, and you can get at the tensions between the accounts in those two very well. The other pairing that I really like is as we know that... this is one that I've taught quite successfully over the years. This is the Mary Doria Russell two-parter, The Sparrow and Children of God. And the great thing about that is that The Sparrow leaves you hanging in one place, and then Children of God takes you off in a completely different direction. And if you space it out well enough, the students have to kind of live with the ending of The Sparrow for a week or two, and then they get into Children of the God, and they go, whoa, what the heck? So the ability to re-examine, the ability to sort of look back at something from building on the foundation of the first version, I think is something that's harder to do if it was a quote-unquote straight class. But generally, yes, I would say that the way I choose the books and the films that I show are precisely the same way as one might choose theoretical sources for other kinds of classes. Here are interesting issues treated in interesting ways that I want people to talk about, and here they are speaking to each other. You know, you already mentioned Starship Troopers. Great thing about Starship Troopers is then you can have students read that and have students read Ender's Game and realize how much of Ender's Game is kind of a rewrite of Starship Troopers. So you've got a lot of those internal references as well, which is really nice.
And then you can, of course, raise the fact that Card emphatically denies that he'd read Starship Troopers prior to Ender's Game and whether that matters, and if so, how.
Right. The way J. Michael Straczynski had never read Tolkien when he invented Khazad-dûm.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it sounds to me like as good a place as any to end this. I think that what we might want to think about doing is a follow-up where we really talked in more detail about some of the kinds of works and the ways of interpreting reading, deploying those works for the purpose of a social science, political science course.
What would actually be really neat to do would be to take things that we've both taught and kind of talk about the way they went over within particular classes. I think that would be really interesting.
We could do that. Well, anyway, those are all ideas for the future. And thanks so much for doing this. And, you know, if it works, we'll do more of them.
Awesome.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
This concludes Duck of Minerva podcast number 1, recorded on July 20th, 2012.